It's the Wonky Show. Students are at work. We've got major new findings out on earning while learning. There's a bunch of complaints about transfers to get across. OFS has a new plan and we'll look ahead to 2025. It's all coming up.
Why the OFS isn't doing it? Well, that's a perennial question, isn't it? I think the sector's been very patient over the past few years, thinking, oh, it's a new regulator. But as the years go on, it's not so new a regulator. It's not finding its feet. It's had time.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to deck the halls with boughs of policy, as usual, three top flight guests. In East London, Shahid Omar is Director of Policy at Universities UK. Shahid, your highlight of the week, please.
I joined a really interesting roundtable on how higher education can play a role in addressing skills gaps identified by industrial strategy and through Skills England. So I was with Diana Beach, which I think is particularly relevant.
Who? Anyway, in Southeast London, Diana Beach is Chief Executive Officer at London Higher. Diana, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Jim, and twice in a week, Shahid. I think my highlight has to be our London Higher reception, which we held earlier this week to mark the end of our 25th anniversary year. It was really lovely to see so many members and sector friends in the room, complete with their guest appearance, the Skills Minister. So for me, it showed just how far we've come as an organisation, and it's a really nice feeling to end the year on.
Great stuff. And in Micklehown on the eastern side of the River Mole Valley, David Kernahan is Deputy Editor at Wonky. DK, your highlight of the week, please.
It's still to come, but we're getting towards the end of the year, and one of my favourite seasonal tasks every year, a local all-female community big band does a concert of Christmas songs, and I get to run the sound. So I'm really looking forward to that on Saturday.
Great stuff. So yes, we start this week with work. This week we've published new polling via our Belong partnership with Sybil. DK, what is it telling us?
So the Wonky and Sybil stuff with Belong is always a really interesting set of data. It's a small survey, 1,461 students. It's not spectacularly representative. You can't really drill down too far into the splits. But every time we do it, what it tells us is absolutely jaw-dropping, and this year is no exception. Significant proportions of students are working. These are full-time students. They're working alongside their studies. This tends to be, in the past, the classic idea of the student job has been in hospitality, work in the bar or in a cafe, or taking on some temp work in the summer. But this is term time. This is effectively full-time work in a lot of cases. This is working in the care industry. This is working in retail. This is working in education, manufacturing. The stat that stuck out for me is over 30% said that their work is very physically or mentally tiring, which surely can't be the best accompaniment to studying at higher educational level.
Well, yes, fascinating stuff. Now, Shahid, one of the things that I've said in the write-up on it is that, of course, it is the case that all work can be well-paid and rewarding and so on, but it also must be the case that some work is more amenable to combination with full-time study than others.
Yeah, well, obviously, and having some reflections around where that could be, how can I put it, where the work opportunities align with a meaningful university experience is quite critical. But what I read from the study was there's a real focus on retail and healthcare. Is that ideal? I don't think so, from my perspective. And actually, it's not always an option for everybody. My daughter has just graduated from university where, frankly, she was told she couldn't work. What do we do about that? Some really troubling findings in that report altogether. And classically, when you get to my age, markedly different from my student experience. And I know that Wonky's been making this case repeatedly and quite rightly too.
Yes, Diana, this obviously there are bits of the sector, notably Oxford and Cambridge still, whose official position is, well, certainly when you're an undergraduate, don't work. Whereas, there are other institutions clearly that have got, a very different institutional attitude. But those differences must also exist within institutions, mustn't they, in terms of individual departmental or program or PSRB requirements and so on and so on. This, we don't really have a settled view on whether students should be working, how much they should be working, do we?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, like Shahid said, from, you know, back in the dark ages when I was a student, some part-time work was actively encouraged as a way to get yourself some practical experience and give yourself the edge in the job market after graduation. But unfortunately now, for many students, it's become a need to have rather than a nice to have. And you just need to have a look at the HEPI, the Higher Education Policy and Annual Student Experience Survey, when they look at the contact hours that different students have. If you're looking at students who are doing, you know, creative industries courses, acting, performing, they're doing so many hours a week, the same as medical students. How do you fit in a part-time job around that without absolutely knackering yourself? It's got to be detrimental to your studies. So I do think we need to go back to the drawing boards and do some thinking about what is realistically possible for students in the current day and age.
Yes, DK, the obviously one of the calculations that you can do back in the HEPI Advanced Actually Student Academic Experience Survey is you can add up the number of independent study hours, contact hours, and the number of hours at work. But of course, one of the other things that is getting to work, and you know, some of the findings that we've got in here suggest that some students are spending a hell of a lot of time on the bus or walking to work.
That's absolutely right. If you look at home students who are working and studying at the same time, you've got like 28% of them are working between half an hour and an hour from their home. And there's about 20% that are working even further away than that. So that's a lot of time on the bus, a lot of time on the train. So the general shift after the pandemic, the pandemic to the idea of blended learning, the idea that you could use these gaps in your day when you're sitting on a bus or whatever to engage with your learning on your phone. I mean, that's going to help a bit for students in this situation, but it's still a long time out of the day. A commute itself is a tiring experience. Just the stress of making sure the train's actually running, that you get to the right place, dealing with rush hour, it's not an optimum way of learning. And you have to think that a student's having that experience is having less opportunity to learn and to practice what they're doing as an undergraduate than a student who is maybe working less hours more locally and can spend time in the library or in the lab or in the studio or whatever it is that they're doing. We should also not forget that all this stuff is socially slanted. If you are from social group C2, D and E, 71% of students are working over the recommended limit of 15 hours. That's just 27% for ABC1. And you have to add on the commute time to that as well. So there are some students out there that are hardly ever getting chance to be students as we might understand it.
One of the things, Shahid, that lots of these data points start to kind of suggest, I think, is that increasingly, whilst we've been concerned over the past decade that the number of part-time students has been declining, increasingly it looks like students, what we used to think of as full-time students, are actually part-time students. It's just that they're getting out into the labour market within 3 years rather than six.
I think that's exactly right. They are part-time students, but without having intended to be the part-time students, and that's really worrying. And particularly because of the reason that David outlined, it really cuts across class lines, and given that we know that those from disadvantaged backgrounds have probably the least social capital, have the most difficult circumstances, and when you think about the transition to the labour market in particular, that compounds that effect. It's something that troubles me a lot, and I've certainly been talking to the NUS and others about how can we make the case for a fairer mainstream maintenance offer overall. But it's an interesting observation. I wonder whether policymakers have caught up with that, because that probably wouldn't be the experience of many people in their 30s and 40s.
Diana, I guess, one of the things that we always do in these pieces of work is do lots of qualitative comments, lots of qualitative analysis. And of course, it is the case that maintenance is an issue here, but it's also the case that students are saying there are some things that universities can do on timetabling, crucially on the availability of part-time work. But anecdotally, what I'm hearing around the country is that as budgets tighten, it's student jobs that are going. You know, is that a solvable puzzle?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Jim. And what I'm hearing here is it's really the London story writ large, and it's now taking hold across country. We've been saying for ages in London that London students are more likely to be commuters with the cost of living, which unfortunately has just got worse, we've just found out. So students really are fitting their studies around their work rather than fitting the work around their studies. That is the new reality that we've got. So you're absolutely right. When the economy is being hit hard, it's the sort of lower wage entry level jobs, if you like, student jobs that are going to get cut. And when there's no option there for students and they become highly competitive, we really do need to ask ourselves, how else are students going to make up the shortfall in money? And there's no easy solution to that.
Yes. Now, DK, as well as this, yesterday we got, we're recording on Thursday. Yesterday we got Scotland's version of the Student Income and Expenditure Survey, which also looks at wellbeing and so on. And it tells a similar picture, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, Jim. In Scotland, the magical figure has always been 10 hours. That comes from the QB Commission back in 1999. Persisted through everything else that's happened since then. The idea students should limit themselves to work 10 hours per week during term time. It turns out that only around 20% of students are actually managing to work 10 hours or less. The overwhelming majority are more than that. And we get some average figures. Undergraduates are around 19 hours a week. Postgraduates, 27 hours a week, which is a little bit of a shocker, really. This reflects to a certain extent the patterns that we've seen from the rest of the UK. I note that the Welsh Student Income and Expenditure Survey is out later on this week, and we'll probably see something similar there as well. But we see the same pattern as you might expect, as you see in the Belong stuff. There's that slant where the students from the most disadvantaged backgrounds are working more during term time than their more advantaged peers. And we've got a parallel, but the same issues with the idea of student work and health, in that it is tiring to do a day job and then to come back to study in the evening. And if you're doing long hours at work, if you're doing a night shift, you're going to miss classes. You're going to miss out on spending the time on your independent work that you're meant to do. If you're a creative student, you're missing out on opportunities to network and perform and all of the rest of the stuff that you need to do as well. So almost exactly the same findings as the Belong stuff, but somehow worse.
Now we had another stocking filler. It's basically student experience day to Christmas this week. We've had another stocking filler under the tree this week, Diana. Happy and Unipol have put stuff out on rent in London.
That's pretty much what I was just trying to say before. What that report has shown is that the average cost of accommodation for London students now outweighs the maximum annual maintenance loan to which students are entitled. So, you know, it's absolutely no wonder that students are increasingly opting to live at home or to take on excessive part-time work, as we've just been speaking about, just to make ends meet. And we should be really worried about this, because London is supposedly the world's best city to be a student. It's held that title for 6 years in a row, and that is an asset for the whole of the UK, not just our capital city region. But how long can it hold that title for and maintain its capital edge if it's just failing to deliver for the students, and they're priced out the market, basically. They can't afford to even rent, let alone pay for food, clothes, books, toiletries, whatever, all the things you need to live. So, I mean, I argue if the current maintenance package doesn't work for London, then London universities can't be actually serving the students who stand to benefit from a transformative education as well. So there's something fundamentally wrong with the system right now.
Yeah, I mean, I, guess we'd have to assume, Diana, that increasingly students studying in London aren't living in London on these numbers, do we?
Yeah, and that's exactly why commuter students are becoming, you know, hyper-commuter students. The zones that the students are willing to travel go out and out to outside the Greater London boundary now, and that's expensive too.
Yeah, one of the things I often say to people is, you can't just have students living away from home and commuter students as separate categories, because there's a big, increasing, it looks like there's a big crossover on that Venn diagram. Anyway, look, Shahid, I guess, you know, one of the other things that kind of comes up on cost of living, of course, maintenance is an important issue, but one of the things that students say repeatedly, certainly in the Belong work, is that one of the things they want to see is efforts to try and get costs down. Now, is that a realistic prospect? Is can universities and the state, perhaps on public transport or whatever, work to get costs down rather than just a hope that maintenance will catch up?
I think it's challenging to get costs down when the wider economy has experienced inflation in so many levels. Now, obviously, the rate of inflation has gone down, but that's not the same as absolute costs coming down. So I think that is a bit of a challenge. Obviously, part of me feels like much of this could be addressed if one could address the housing crisis. I mean, if that could be addressed, as Labour is committed to doing, then that could be quite powerful indeed. So, yeah, is that a realistic ask? I'm not sure. Overall, bringing the cost down, can we do more around housing in particular? I think yes, we must do more, because it's having a multi-dimensional effect on so many different areas, and not least, you know, around things like, yes, the student experience, but even more broadly, our economy is a consumption economy, it's a services economy, and Diana was referring to the nature of the jobs available even on a part-time basis. If you can do more to have more disposable income, that could have an overall positive aggregate impact, and so much of that is driven by just how much we spend on housing. I think that's our best chance and hope.
DK, I guess the other thing, you know, in all of this stuff is when governments talk about student financial support, they almost always, perhaps inevitably, talk about undergraduate support. But, you know, one of the things that's pretty clear, you know, in Scotland, in England, and maybe we'll learn more about Wales later, is that home domicile participation in PGT is falling from its kind of, you know, post-pandemic do a panic masters uptick. And, you know, pretty much all of the surveys are saying, students are saying that what were always designed as loans to cover tuition fees and maintenance aren't getting close. And at some point, surely, given the way in which PGT facilitates access to the professions, people are going to start to worry about that from an access point of view, aren't they?
People should have been worrying about this a long time ago. We've seen a long, slow decline in home postgraduate student numbers, both in terms of number overall, and even more surprisingly, in terms of the number of people that are actually taking up the loans. The current loan offer for postgraduate, it doesn't really seem to be working if its purpose is to support students that can benefit from postgraduate provision into courses that they wouldn't otherwise get into. Overwhelmingly, the postgraduate population is from a well-to-do background, has some level of independent means, be that money from the family or be that a little bit of time in a good job, in order to pay for their studies and support their living costs. It's almost as if it's not really a problem that's been properly thought about in all of the stuff under the recent government, where all of the emphasis has been on level 4 and level 5 skills or below, and we've had all the concerns that we saw every week in the broadsheets that there are too many students doing undergraduate courses. Every survey of employer needs, every projection of employer needs coming out with the old unit from Future Skills or the new Skills England has suggested that we are going to need a lot more postgraduates if we're going to be in a growing innovative economy that we seem to be aspiring to be doing. The kind of support that you get for postgraduate things, where it's just a pot of money that is paid into your account and you can take out as much as you want, and you get to use that on either tuition fees or on your living costs or both, it's just not fit for purpose. There needs to be some kind of subsidy for a wider range of professional postgraduate courses. We currently have little bits and pieces in random, kind of nonsensical stuff like artificial intelligence, we need to expand that into actual real courses that actually get people's jobs.
I mean, this is fascinating, Dana, isn't it? Because on the one hand, DK's right. You know, you look forward, and there are lots of, you know, pieces of work that suggest we need more graduates, we need more postgraduates. But on the other side, we've got a participation in the labour market problem, and presumably, without saying it out loud, there are bits of government that will be thrilled that so many students are at work because they're filling vacancies that can't be filled by anybody else.
Yeah, but they're not the kind of vacancies that are going to boost the productivity and growth that the government wants, and that's the reality about it. It's not a case of having too many graduates. It's having a case of not having the right jobs, I think. We haven't got our skill system sorted out. And what DK said is absolutely right. We need higher level skills. I mean, the health secretary just spoke about it the other week, about the importance of leadership skills and senior management, because you've got that ripple effect and a trickle down effect. You get good high level skilled managers, and they inspire the next, you know, those working for them, the next generation. And that is what boosts the company up as a whole. So that's what we really need to sort out. And the current government decision to try and axe, you know, level 7 degree apprenticeships, well, that just flies in the face of any of those ambitions. So, you know, there's a lot of integrated policy out there at the moment that really needs sorting out.
Shahid, if the government actually had a strategy around students earning while learning, what you know, what could it look like? Because certainly the Get Britain Working plan and the legislation, the Employment Rights Bill that's going through Parliament, really seem to have thought about students at all.
No, and you're quite right. And there is an opportunity here if we could think about it in a coherent way, to think about things like placements, paid for internships, really careful thinking between DWP and DfE around this, which could make the subsequent from undergrad, the transition from undergrad into the labour market just a lot smoother than it is right now. But I really want to pick up on Diana's point, which I think is a really critical point, and Diana and David's point. It strikes me as almost entirely incoherent to no longer fund level 7 apprenticeships via the apprenticeships levy, given earning while you're learning. But also, if you looked at all the industrial strategy, the 8 growth sectors they've identified, they very heavily rely on graduates, very heavily. If you look at the composition, it ranges between 60 to 90%, depending on the sector. And if, you know, one could reasonably infer from that some of their success, perhaps not all, but some of their success might be driven by the human capital that they currently possess. So what you want to do is go up the value chain rather than anything else. And so I was frustrated and puzzled by that particular decision. So yes, I mean, in summary, I think once Skills England is fully up and running, bringing this all together into a coherent strategy, as you know, your question implied that you think there's a deficit in that space. I think that could be really quite powerful indeed, but we're not there yet. But I'm looking forward to the point where we might be.
Yes, and DK, there's still no sign of postgraduate, you know, level 7 stuff appearing anywhere near the LLE, is there? Lifelong learning is not for that bit.
No, it would be such an easy win to add in any postgraduate entitlement to the undergraduate only LLE and just say, okay, you've got a degree, you need to do further support. Suppose the example is that, I suppose the issue is that there is a sense in which that's the kind of thing that employers should probably be paying for themselves. If they train their staff, they're going to be more productive, they're going to get better outcomes, it's going to hit their bottom line. That's an argument that needs to be made better by the sector and by ministers. It's historically not washed very well with employers. I mean, UK employers are terrible at providing credentialed training to their staff. There was a report out from the OECD this week, which is always my least favorite source of data about higher education for reasons you can read on the site. But the suggestion is that a lot of people are overqualified in the UK, but that's not necessarily the case. It's because the roles keep expanding to take on new responsibilities, and people are using their skills in unexpected expected ways, but because to get onto that particular job, you don't necessarily need a degree or a postgraduate, it is coded as somebody being overqualified. It's a little loop we seem to have gotten into in this country in terms of qualifications, in terms of skills, in terms of productivity. And I think you're absolutely right. Adding the postgraduate entitlement to the LLE could help here.
Well, fascinating stuff. Plenty more on all of that on the site. And we'll be discussing lots of that at the Secret Life of Students in March. Details in the show notes. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Madeline Pownall. I'm an associate professor in psychology at the University of Leeds. And this week on Wonky, I've been blogging with Pam Birtle and Richard Harris about how universities might want to think carefully and critically about using the term global citizenship to describe graduate attributes. We ran a study of undergraduate students across different universities and different disciplines, and we wanted to know what students thought about global citizenship education as part of a Leeds Institute for Teaching Excellence fellowship that we held together. We found that the majority of students had never heard of global citizenship education, but when we provided them with a definition and some examples, they were generally sympathetic to the goals of global citizenship education. They did, however, identify some real issues with the connotations of both global and citizenship that we need to think really carefully about as a sector.
Now, the OIA has put out a collection of case summaries on transfers. Shahid, what's going on here?
The OIA, as you say, has put out, published really helpful resources on student transfer complaints. Which is basically complaints that come its way in situations where students have transferred to a new course, campus, and provider or provider. What we're seeing here is, frankly, an articulation of the typical cases that the OIA would have to review. And I think this is a really useful treasure or resource for folk to really think about what they might do in a situation ahead of a situation where they may have to make some of these decisions. So, like, for example, there was a case where a student who had to change course after the first one lost their PSRB accreditation, where there was a provider that arrived at the provider arrived at a settlement with the student. There was another who transferred when modules were unavailable, which again was settled in favor of the complainant stroke student. But there are also cases where complaints weren't justified. And for those institutions who are thinking about this and kind of assessing, okay, well, how do we calibrate our actions? This could have a system wide effect. I'm really grateful for the OIA for publishing this. If I were to offer two takeaways, one is that my sense is that there is a system that works here to protect the student interests, and the OIA is doing a great job. And I should add that they're probably one of my favourite stakeholders in my interactions. And my other takeaway is that we really do need some greater alignment between the OFS and the OIA. It's kind of trying to reconcile what the OIA is talking about and some of the concerns it rightly has about the consequences of the strains that the HE system is under financially, alongside some of the statements around from the OFS around bold and transformative action and a radical rethinking of the model. Those two things, it's hard to reconcile those two things that happening at the same time. So how does that work? Looking forward to seeing greater alignment between those two organisations.
Diana, it's fascinating to me this, because, you know, one of the cases is about a bunch of modules not being there anymore. One is about accreditation not being there anymore. One's about a campus not being there anymore. One's about reasonable adjustments not being there anymore. And one's about a course not being there anymore. Now, you know, I don't think it's an unfair assumption to assume that those are the sorts of things that will be being proposed and implemented right now as a result of, you know, financial pressures and OFS putting the pressure on around financial sustainability. Why is it that we've got the OIA offering advice on all of that stuff that relates to student experience and not OFS?
Well, as Shahid said, I mean, all credit to the OIA for coming out with this. I'm a big fan of what works. I mean, how do we learn to go forward from what's worked and what hasn't? So if we're sharing that experience, then that's all the, you know, all the stronger for the sector. Why the OFS isn't doing it? Well, that's a perennial question, isn't it? I think the sector's been very patient over the past few years thinking, oh, it's a new regulator. But as the years go on, it's not so new a regulator. It's not finding its feet. It's had time. What we are seeing with the new strategy, though, is a reset. I'm very glad that they have been transparent and put that out publicly as well. I'm going to declare that I haven't ploughed through all the detail yet, but I hope what is in there is a big engagement piece. So it's listening to its other stakeholders, students, institutions, but also great institutions like the OIA, and taking their experience and learning from it. My warning to the OFS will be, these case studies are all well and good, but they are a snapshot in time. What we need to be doing is future planning with them as well, thinking outside the box. Okay, so this has happened. What could happen next if the sector situation is getting worse? So we've got to be using them and running with them. And that's the OFS's job.
DK, obviously the OIA has got a fairly, you know, robust theory of change, right? So it gets some of the complaints, you know, that have kind of gone wrong or not been resolved. And then occasionally it puts out little collections like this. And then in theory, the sector reads them and thinks, well, I will do that, I won't do that, blah, 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 blah. But surely if the financial pressures are really acute and, you know, the risk is that you go under or OFS comes after you versus the risk that the odd student gets as far as the OIA, surely that risk overplays that risk of, you know, being caught out by the OIA in 18 months or whatever.
It's a very good question, Jim. Obviously, every provider, if you start reading through the annual reports and accounts that are starting to come out from the sector, every provider that I've seen so far has been doing some serious work on updating its risk register. Now, classically, a risk register is just something that sits in the corner and gathers dust and explains what your university would do in the event of a zombie apocalypse. At the moment, things are feeling a little more real than that. So providers are starting to make serious plans, particularly about financial crises, also increasingly about, I mean, kind of random changes in regulation, of which they've seen several and will probably see several more. So they are starting to think about this. Obviously, if you're in a financial squeeze, one of the things that is going to get squeezed is the quality of the student experience. And as we both know, the first students to get hit are those that are on the edges, that are not quite within the mainstream of what majority of the students are doing. We've never really thought seriously about transfer of credit or transferring between institutions in the UK, apart from to an extent in Scotland, because they've got their tradition of moving from FE colleges to HE providers as part of an undergraduate career. It doesn't really work anywhere else. It's always something that's done by exception. It's always something that's kind of hand knitted. It's the bit where the student data professionals actually have to get out and update the spreadsheet manually. It's always been the edge case of an edge case. And those are always going to be the first students that are going to suffer. Credit transfer, student experience transfer, student transfers more generally, has been a problem that sectors face for a number of years. Everybody's always assumed that somebody else is going to step in and fix it. I mean, Universities UK seems to assume that the government's going to step in and regulate. The regulator seems to think that probably Universities UK will knock something up. Individual providers think, oh, they don't need to do anything personally because they think, you know, it'll be a sector-wide solution. And at a sector level, everybody's saying, so this is really a matter for individual providers. It's an absolute shambles. It's been a shambles for getting on for 40, 50 years, and it shows absolutely no sign of being fixed in the near future.
Shahid, obviously, you know, I think it would probably be fair to say that presumably on some level or another, the amount of institutions, amount of providers that are making savings right now, that the level of savings being made can't be having zero impact on quality. And I guess the question then is, does it start to get near to the minimum level of quality? Now, OFS has its, you know, way of measuring quality, but, you know, there's a number of case summaries in here from PSRBs, and I don't get much of a sense, to you, about where PSRBs are on, you know, significantly increased working hours for students or significantly increased staff-student ratios. You know, where are the PSRBs, and will one of them start to bite at some point?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, and it's something that I'm quite conscious of around, like,
getting a collective view on with PSRBs and you know, I suppose being candid, it's hard to do that. There are just so many of them, and how do you get an aggregated assessment of that? But it will bite, and that's the thing that's worrying me about this. At some point, things like staff student ratios will have an effect. Yes, the maintenance offer will have an effect on student and their experience. All of these things come together to have an impact on quality. That's why there's a kind of almost inherent tension around government, perhaps rightly, but saying, look, are you as efficient as you can, as you could be, while at the same time saying, but we really need to focus on quality. You know, if optimistically, there shouldn't be a trade-off, but there nearly always is a bit of a trade-off in all of this. So I don't think I have a good answer, but it's something that worries me a lot. And then particularly what this means for the experience for disadvantaged students. I think that's the thing that I'm really troubled by, because they're in that kind of that slightly horrible, they're in the middle of that slightly horrible Venn diagram that I just described.
Diana, do you get a sense that the government sort of knows what's happening here, and that on one level or another thinks, well, you know, it's time that the sector you know, cut its cloth and made some savings and did some transformation? You know, does it understand the sort of impact that are kind of rolling out here, and if it doesn't, you know, where, how can it understand those impacts?
Jim, I'd love to say yes, but I can't. I don't think it does understand. No, I think there's all these plans going on in different pockets of the DfE. In particular, you've got lifelong learning in one corner, apprenticeships over there, quality and standards over in the next corner, but they're not all linked in. And you can see that there's all the talk of a tertiary post 16 skills system at the moment. Well, we've just been speaking about the regulatory inconsistencies between PSRBs and higher education providers. What we're going to do when we bring in FE into the loop as well. We've already got the interplay between the OFS and Ofsted and the potential duplication there in the apprenticeship space, but it's much, much wider than that. So I think there's just a lack of join up across the piece, and we need to really go back to design principles and actually get this sort of fleshed out and work from the bottom up. It's a lot harder than it is just saying it. I appreciate that. But if it's going to work, it can't just be pockets of people in different corners of the DfE working on different plans. It's got to be pulled together centrally and cohesively.
Now, DK, the other thing that has happened this week, we've talked about this briefly, is that the Office for Students has put its new draft strategy out, and it repeats a couple of the things that we've seen in a number of OFS strategies, I have to say, which are broadly about students getting what they were promised. Now, this is almost impossible, isn't it, if the sector's suddenly making lots of savings and cuts and reductions? If the sector is getting smaller, how on earth can a student who's looking at a provider today get what they were promised in 4 or 5 years' time?
I mean, the strategy, as you say, is a classic of the form, in that it's lots of stuff that the regulator either has been doing already or should be doing already. And there's to be clear, there is a lot to welcome on it. I like the focus on an explicit risk basis in terms of quality. The idea of a quality risk register. If you're an OFS criminology, you could see that as another win for the John Blake faction that seemed to be taking over pretty much every aspect of what the regulator does. Interesting to keep an eye on, I think. But as you say, the quality is inevitably going to suffer under financial pressure. And it is entirely conceivable that a university, in all good faith, will make all kinds of promises to incoming students about what they might experience. And it will turn out that it's no longer feasible to do that. I was talking to somebody, a provider, a couple of days ago, who has got a long-standing partnership with a local theatre. So their drama students and such like have always had that access to the theatre. Such are the financial situations in that particular provider, and they can no longer afford to maintain that partnership. Now, on one level, you think, okay, all universities need to cut costs, and maybe a partnership with a theatre is not the best way of using that money. Maybe they could do other equivalent stuff. But on the other hand, if a student had signed up to a course on that basis, that they'd get to work and learn actually in a professional theatre, that they would have every right to complain and then to take that complaint to the OIA. The question really is, what is the role of the regulator in this? Is it the role of the regulator that needs to stand there and say, you promised these students a theatre, you have to give them a theatre or you will face regulatory consequences? On one level, yes. On the other level, how does that play out? How does that actually help? If you're cutting literally everything outside of maintaining the campus and staff pay because you are desperately trying to keep the bare bones of courses afloat, if you've got somebody from Bristol ringing up and telling you off for cancelling a particular partnership, or what are you going to do? Are you going to stop doing something else and restart the partnership? Are you going to disadvantage a different group of students and not give them the experience they were promised because the OFS has put you up on this one thing? It's an extraordinarily difficult regulatory role to do. There are going to be trade-offs. It needs to be done in a way that's not going to absolutely destroy the student experience, but the OFS need to be perceptive in understanding how this is playing out and ideally making the case to government for additional funding for the sector.
But if we look at this from a sort of trade-offs point of view, Shahid, I mean presumably there aren't providers that are keen to phone OFS and go, you know, in DK's example, we're going to have to get rid of this theatre partnership we've promised students. And at the moment, OFS doesn't even collect a course closure as a reportable event. So, you know, with all the focus on financial sustainability, there's an almost no kind of data points and no confidence to feed upwards the way in which the student experience might be cut. That does choke off intel to ministers, doesn't it?
I think that's exactly right. And in many ways, and this is where the OFS's focus on financial sustainability and the additional resources given it is not unhelpful for persuading ministers, persuading the Treasury, etc., that there is an empirical basis for making the arguments that we at UK, alongside Diana and others in the sector, have been making. That's almost a critical precondition for further investment. So that needs to happen. It needs to happen quickly. And I welcome it, actually, even though it may feel slightly intrusive for some of our members, given what I've just said. I did have a couple of other reflections on the OFS strategy too, which I like, as with David, I think there's much to admire there and I really welcome it. There were a couple of things that kind of, I suppose, fairly niggled at me. The disproportionate emphasis on governance. There is a systemic issue here and it kind of risks into implying, and probably more than implying, that, well, actually, if only there was effective governance in these institutions, you can ride this out. That is just not the case. And need to be really careful about offering simplistic solutions in particular. And then the other bit, it's more what was missing. Hard to see many stop it. Hard to see many areas where they felt like, yeah, it's like, actually, we realize the burden. We realize that you are under strain. Here are the things that we will no longer ask you to do beyond like data. But that was it. That was almost the limit of its ambition around identifying stop it. So, as I say, much to admire. A couple of bits that slightly made me pause.
Yes, that probably reflects wider conversations in government, which we'll get to shortly. On it's always harder to stop doing things than it is to kind of announce new things. Now, great. Oh, lots more on the site about all of this. All this season, we've been having a think about how things were and how things came to be. With City St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, here's the final for the time being, Hidden History of HE.
So if you look at the Robbins Report, which stands as a marker of where we were in early 1960s higher education in the UK, you'll find that there's a whole chapter dedicated for the Colleges of Education and Training of Teachers. Because when Robbins wrote, there were 146 colleges in the UK delivering teacher training, and they had 49,000 students, which is about a quarter of the whole of the higher education sector. And at that point, they were still dealing with the repercussions of some very serious manpower power planning that the government had done, and planning for a huge expansion. There was talk about the number of trainee teachers needing to go up to 114,000 across the sector. So Robin spends a lot of time thinking about what is going to happen to all these colleges of higher education. There's a concern that many of them are too small, haven't got a critical mass in terms of what they're trying to do. So there's a discussion about whether they should become liberal arts colleges, whether they could develop in that direction. Robin suggests that they move towards having a Bachelor of Education degree rather than the Cert Ed that they have been offering. And the government swings into action with all its normal planning and foresight that puts everything together. If you look at the buildings built by these county architects at this point, they look just like the new universities that are being put up. So you can put the Walsall campus or the West Midlands College of Education next to Lancaster or Warwick, and for the shiny black and white photos, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. They are doing the same kind of thing. They're developing a residential experience for students, but focused on teacher education. But by the beginning of the 1970s, all of this has changed. The James Committee looks at the future of higher education in teacher training, and they suggest that what would be good is to have a DIP HE route, because you probably only need 2 years of a general education before you go off and do teacher training. And that would also be a good way for the colleges to diversify. It's a way that they don't have to have the research expertise that you'd expect in the final year. So the DIP HE is born as an idea, the idea that you could have a short stage higher education qualification that you could then top up with professional training. So it's the beginning of our first short cycle award. But also notes that the planning forecasts for teacher training have changed quite radically, because people have counted how many children are coming forward and that the teachers aren't retiring. And therefore, there's a major shift in terms of the numbers that they think about. So they shift this idea that they will have about 100,000 down to about 60,000. So this is a tremendous change in terms of manpower planning, probably an argument for saying the government should never do manpower planning again. So the white paper that Mrs. Thatcher puts out, a framework for expansion in terms of education, has to deal with the fact that there are now 160 of these colleges, but they are comparatively small and inconveniently located for development into larger general purpose institutions. Some of them will be needed just for teacher education. Some might develop in other directions. And cheerfully, this being a white paper, some must face the possibility that in due course, they will have to be converted to new purposes. Some may need to close. And then sets about this extraordinary planned exercise, of which you can find loads of books complaining about because it's just done awfully, of deciding which of the colleges are going to close. And they work their way methodically through it. They have to deal with the churches, who are quite important in this area. So there's discussions with the Catholic Board of Education and the Church of England, who have a sense of which ones they want to keep going. There's some thinking about where things are located, because when they were trying to fill in every available area and make sure they had a teacher training college, suddenly that doesn't make sense. So there's some interesting shifts in terms of that. There's local considerations, which college is going to survive, which is going to merge with a polytechnic. So here locally, there are three colleges of education: Clifton College, Mary Ward and Newark. They all are in the running to join Trent Poly, but only Clifton College does. The others close outright. And in Mary Ward's case, this is a Catholic college that's been put out in the countryside near Nottingham. It had only opened in 1969, and within 3 years they were discussing having to close it. Now, they sold the site to the British Geological Survey, so that's fine, its site got used, but these kind of conversations go on, and brand new colleges are just closed down again. So it's just one of those monumental failures. Now, some of the colleges that survive, either through merger or just on their own, are the foundations of a wave of universities that we get in this century. So Chester's and Winchester's and Chichester's, the kind of cathedral town colleges of education. But some of the places that lose their colleges of education have never really got it back in terms of the development. So places like Grantham or Salisbury, they lose their college of education. They never get it back again. They're left with a College of Technology, an FE college. They don't get a higher education presence back again in the same kind of a way. And it's a bit of a lottery how all that works out. But the prospect that the government grows a sector and then 5 years later contracts it desperately is just one of those sad little stories of how we've ended up in our current situation.
Now, finally this week, it's spending review season again. Diana, explain the process for us.
Yeah, so it's spending review season in Whitehall, and that is the process by which the UK government sets out public spending plans for all of its departments. And this year, it's going to be a big one, because not only is there a spending review process of this new Labour government, but it's also going to be setting budgets for the next 3 years, so that's right up to 2029, together with a five-year programme capital spending. So essentially, what that means is whatever's decided this spring, and that's a loose definition of government spring, will shape government spending for the rest of this parliament. And the negotiating window has already begun. We've got 6 months in which we can expect government departments to be making their case for bigger slices of the budget pie, if you like. They're going to be arguing to Treasury for more money. But the Treasury also wants to see departmental waste cut by 5%. And they also want to see plans that focus on the Prime Minister's missions and his new milestones. So really, the question for our sector is, who's going to be fighting the corner for higher education in Whitehall, and how?
Now, Shahid, obviously, Darren Jones will be roaming his way around Ministry. Darren Jones, of course, former Students' Union president at the University of Plymouth Students' Union. I trained him once. Will be roaming his way around the government departments, having difficult conversations. What are you going to be saying to the Treasury?
The helpful thing about the university sector, it is actually an agent of economic growth. And that's the principal mission. And we can make that case. And obviously at UK, we work with London Economics to talk about the kind of the total economic impact of universities. But then that's not just the RD&I spillovers, but the human capital formation aspect too. And it really is quite significant. So that's clearly we're part of the solution. And please, frankly, don't treat universities as a cost. And I think that's fundamentally quite different. So that's the case we're going to make. Our views on what we should be asking for are fairly transparent. We publish them, etc. We definitely need to do more around teaching and the cost of teaching and addressing that. We'd like to see more on the sustainable R&D, of course, because I think that's really critical, and it's currently an unsustainable stability around international student recruitment, which I think is really important as a kind of a component of the funding picture. But then also there were things such as TPS and the degree of flexibility. All of these things are kind of having an aggregate effect on the sector. But I think the universities are just really well positioned to be talking about we're part of the solution. And then please don't treat us, and you shouldn't treat us as a cost. And for those who don't know, I'm a civil servant on loan to UK, and I will be returning back to government shortly. The SR is an interesting and complex process, and there will be trade-offs across the system. So I'm under no illusion. This is a very difficult fiscal inheritance that Labour has.
Right. So the ground rules of this particular spending review are very, very interesting. This is what's called a line-by-line review, which means they're not just going to be looking at proposals for new spending. Oh, we could do that. They're looking at the justification for every piece of spending that exists in government currently, which is a value of roughly £1.2 trillion.
That Elon Musk is proposing for the US.
A little bit like that. There are elements. Also, similar levels of technology. There is a fantastic quote from Darren Jones in the Financial Times who says, there's a dashboard that starts flashing at them if they type in too much money for their budget. He says, it tells them they've blown their budget and also how much we'd have to put up taxes to pay for the extra spending, indicating somebody in the Treasury had mastered conditional formatting on Excel. So, well done for them. So this is the first time we've done this proper zero-based study of government spending since Alistair Darling in 2007. The budget for the next years has already been set in terms of the overall envelope. We got that in Rachel Reeder's budget, and that's not going to change. So the message needs to be there's not really going to be any more money that suddenly appears, especially not at the scale that some in the higher education sector might like in terms of actually fixing the funding model. It is going to be a matter of stopping doing some things to concentrate on other things. And I think for the sector, the most effective lobbying is not going to be the traditional, we need a load more money, because obviously we need a load more money. Everybody in the public sector needs a load more money. If you've had to negotiate with any part of the public sector in the recent past, you will know that. That is going to be the fundamental lobbying. The best kind of lobbying will be along the lines of, okay, we should stop doing this, but we shall start doing this. And it'll be looking at things that are being cut already, such as, say, Foundation Year's classroom-based funding is being cut. That's just saving overall that is going to government. There is a case looking at the amount of money that would save and saying, okay, we would like to spend that money on this stuff that we think is important. Maybe it is looking at the sector overall of an entire innovation and skills system and thinking about what they need. Maybe it's, could be anything. But the action is not going to be in the pleas for more spending. The action is going to be in the cuts that are volunteered up to unlock the potential to do other things with that same money. So that is the direction I would imagine Universities UK are thinking. That is the direction that all of the sector lobby groups need to be thinking. If that, then this, to coin the phrase of a popular tool widely used at Wonky.
So that's about it for this year. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Shahid, Diana, DK, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. Thanks for all your support in 2024. We'll be back next year. Until then, stay wonky.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. May the Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us will be near to us once more. Someday soon we all will be together. If the fates allow, until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas now.